Hi everyone, let me welcome you on behalf of Harvard College Effective Altruism, a student group belonging to a fast-growing global movement that tries to find out what the best ways of doing good are by using reason and evidence. This talk is a part of our speaker series that involves speakers such as Peter Singer, Darren Acemoglu, which will feature in next week, which is the Effective Altruism Week. So if you're interested in Effective Altruism, definitely come to the events next week and get in touch with us. So now that you're sold for Effective Altruism, let me introduce tonight's speaker. Eli Hassenfeld is the co-founder of GiveWell, an independent charity evaluator that was founded in 2007 by Eli and Holden Karnofsky. GiveWell focuses on in-depth research to determine which charities do the most good. So without further ado, please welcome Eli Hassenfeld.
Thanks all for coming. It's great to be here. It's great to see some of you again. I know I've been here a few times in the past, so it's great to see all this interest in what we do and in effective altruism in general. What I wanted to do this evening was talk relatively briefly and leave a bunch of time for you to ask any questions that you have about GiveWell in particular, the work we do, or effective altruism in general. What I'm going to focus my talk on is first a little bit of background on GiveWell, how we got started, and our trajectory to get to where we are today. Then talk a little bit about what we're currently focused on and where we are heading in the future. So GiveWell started in 2007 after Holden and I were working at a hedge fund. We'd gone there right out of undergrad. And after being there for a couple of years, we realized that we were making more money than we needed to pay our bills. And so that led us to the obvious conclusion that we should try to give some money to charity. When we attacked that question, we expected to be able to find a really good answer. What charity accomplishes the most good? And instead, we found virtually no information available that could answer this question. So I picked the cause of water in Africa, and I was looking for answers to questions like, if you donate $20 to a water charity, what does that accomplish? How many wells will they dig? How long will those wells last? Will the waters in the well stay clean? And instead, the information that we were able to find was things like the percentage that a charity spends on overhead versus its programs, or the charities would send us like really large packets of marketing materials, but virtually nothing that addressed the substantive questions of how well their programs worked or how much good they accomplished. So after working on this part-time for a while and having some other coworkers get involved in this project, we realized, Holden and I, that this was something we were extremely excited about. So, I mean, I remember being up like really late on weekend evenings reading really, well, boring to most people, exciting to me, papers about digging wells in Africa. And I think that we recognized that this was a project that we were really excited about. We knew from personal experience that the information didn't already exist. And we saw that there was a huge amount of money in the United States. About 3/4 of charitable dollars comes from individuals. So we saw that there was a huge amount of money that was going to charities with virtually no information available to help donors make better decisions. And so we started GiveWell as a full-time project after about a year of this part-time work. And that was then in the middle of 2007 to try to create the resource that we were looking for when we were trying to give to charity. And I think if in the fall of 2006, the GiveWell or the GiveWell equivalent already existed, I would probably still be in my old job doing what I was doing. And we started this because it was something that we didn't see in the world. For the first few years, I think a lot of the challenges that we faced were trying to figure out what approach to research was going to make the most sense and trying to figure out how we could increase the scale of our operation. So I'll try to describe both of those in a little bit more detail. I think the first question that we had to answer is, what type of research should we be doing? We knew that we wanted to find the best charities we could. We knew that we wanted to make the information publicly available because no one was going to listen to two 25-year-old kids who left finance about where to give to charity. And so we wanted to put this information out there so anyone could vet it. But we didn't really have a sense of whether there was a particular cause we would focus on, what questions were most important, how we would go about finding charities. So when we started, we actually broke our work into two separate areas. Half of what we did was focused on developing world aid, and half of our work is focused on developed world causes like job training, education, childcare, homelessness. And it was after our first year of work that we saw how different the impact per dollar that a donor could achieve was for the developing world rather than the developed world causes. So as a this might be intuitive to many of you, but as a rough approximation, you know, our best guess now is that for every roughly $3,500 that someone donates to the Against Malaria Foundation, you save a life. On the other hand, it costs on the order of $15,000 to put a child through a year of school in something like the Knowledge is Power program, KIPP, a charter school network. Now, there's a lot of ways that that number might not tell you everything that you need to know, but the difference between $15,000 for a year of school versus $3,500 per life saved led us to the conclusion that we should be focusing more of our efforts on developing world aid if we wanted to find the most impactful places to give per dollar. Another big question that we had is what type of research should we be doing to appeal to donors and have the most impact possible? When I talked to people about GiveWell, still when I talk to people about GiveWell, one of the most common questions that people have is, what's the best charity in category X? So what's the best homelessness charity? What's the best education charity? What's the best water charity? What's the best cancer charity? What's the best, literally someone said this to me, what's the best women's immigration issues in Boston charity. So we knew we could never get to that level of specificity in the charities we looked at, but because this was such a common refrain, from the time we launched in the middle of 2007 through the end of 2010, the long-term model we had in mind was what I'd call the menu model to charity research. We were going to try and cover causes. We'd start with the big ones that lots of people were interested in and slowly get narrower and narrower. But the only way that we would be able to influence a lot of dollars was by going cause by cause and creating this menu. And so if you look back at GiveWell's history, you'll see things like in 2009, we spent a ton of time researching microfinance. In 2010, we spent a lot of time researching U.S. causes again, not because we thought that it was going to be the best place to give, but because we thought researching that type of cause would help us appeal to a large group of donors and help them give more effectively. And we made aborted attempts to look into things like disease research, so cancer or other diseases that people want to give to. And it wasn't until the beginning of 2011, so this is now, roughly 3.5 years into GiveWell's history, that we shifted our focus and decided that we were only going to focus on finding or searching for the places that we thought would be the most effective places to give to. And this was largely driven by two factors. First, we saw that as we researched the developed world causes, we just weren't as interested in them because we didn't expect to give there. And so when we were researching for people who had different values than ours, we were not doing as good a job on the research as when we were literally trying to figure out where we would give our money at the end of the year. And that's been a lot of what drives the annual GiveWell cycle of research, is trying to figure out where we as donors ourselves will end up giving. The other thing we noticed at the end of the year was that we had something that approached a mini menu of charitable organizations and causes. So if you look back at our top charities page from 2010, and it's still archived on our website, you can find it. We recommended an education charity, a childcare charity, microfinance. I think we had an AIDS charity and a charity that we targeted as focused on women's issues in the developing world. And so there was this menu. But we saw that the vast majority of donations that were influenced by our research went to Village Reach, which was our number one rated charity at the time. And so this led us to this conclusion that I think that the donors who primarily follow GiveWell's research, have more or less similar values to the ones that we did at the time that now I think we carry forward as an organization. And instead of trying to appeal to a broad array of donors, instead we're trying to serve a relatively small niche of donors. Small, perhaps, in the scheme of all the donors in the world. I think that, though, that the size of those donors probably adds up to a significant amount of money. And if you're interested in, this whole progression at all, we wrote a blog post at the beginning of 2011 that was called a big picture shift in priorities, which describes this shift in more depth. And so as we came into 2011, I think that was the year where GiveWell really hit its stride. And by the end of the year, the two recommendations we made then, the Against Malaria Foundation and the Schistosomiasis Control Initiative, more or less represented the types of organizations and the types of research process that we're still carrying forward on, GiveWell today. The other big event of 2011 was early that year we met Kerry Tuna and Dustin Moskovitz. Dustin is one of the co-founders of Facebook, and he and Kerry were just at the beginning of thinking about how they would undertake their philanthropy. And while I think the answers that GiveWell was giving donors in 2011, 2010 were really excellent and better than anything else that was out there for donors giving $10,000 a year, maybe $100,000 a year, they weren't answering the types of questions that the billionaire philanthropist could have. Because when you're a small donor, you don't have the resource to hire your own staff. You have to write a check that will go to an existing organization, and it's almost impossible for you to cause them to spend those funds in a way that they otherwise would not have. But if you have significantly more funding to give, if you have millions of dollars to give, all of a sudden you can find a cause that seems under-resourced and create organizations from scratch, make a cause a bigger deal than it already was. And so in 2011, we launched what we called then GiveWell Labs, what we call now the Open Philanthropy Project. And it was essentially trying to be the same type of resource that GiveWell was for smaller donors, but serving in the short term Good Ventures, which is the foundation that Kerry and Dustin created, and in the longer term, other very large donors. And the Open Philanthropy Project is conceptually the same type of thing as GiveWell. We're trying to find outstanding giving opportunities. We're publishing the analysis that we do to help those donors decide where to give. And the key difference is that we are dropping a key criterion that GiveWell uses, which is that organizations we recommend have a track record of success. And so where GiveWell says, before I recommend you, I want to see that your programs are cost-effective, that they have a demonstrated track record, that you are transparent, and therefore we think you will make, with additional vetting, will make good use of marginal funding, the Open Philanthropy Project drops the track record criterion, leaving it open to opportunities that are higher risk and potentially higher reward. So what I want to do now is just shift a little bit into what we're currently working on now at GiveWell and where I think we might be going in the future, and then I'll just open things up for whatever questions you all have. So the single biggest priority at GiveWell, and when I talk about GiveWell, I'm talking both about the traditional research we do and the Open Philanthropy Project, is building capacity. And what I mean by that is trying to find more people who can help us do the research that we need to do. Because we have significantly more work to do than we're able to with our current staff. And when we have successfully brought people on in the past, they've added a huge amount of resources to do research to what we have. So that basically takes a few different forms. We're, you know, currently undertaking a pretty intense recruiting effort. We're trying to hire roughly 10 additional people by the end of the year. We're currently a staff of 18, so that will bring us up to a staff of 25 to 30, depending on exactly how many we bring on. We're trying to bring on a bunch of summer research analysts, because that is that is a great way for us to, we mostly see it as a recruiting tool to see what people can do when they're on the job for a few months, let them get to know us better. And so we hope that those people turn into full-time workers down the line. And, you know, our basic goal is that these people that we're bringing on now essentially lead to the future of what GiveWell becomes. And so it takes us a year or two of training often for people to get up to speed and fully understand what we're doing and be able to contribute as much as we hope they can. But, you know, we've seen this happen over and over again, and it's the people who were graduating college in 2012 who've, you know, now been at GiveWell for a few years that are sort of the future leaders of what GiveWell is doing. And so while this, I'm happy to describe this in more detail if anyone's interested. I know that it may be a little bit hard to sort of see from in the abstract or at this level, but it is probably the single thing that we're focusing most of our energy on right now because we think it's what's necessary for GiveWell's future success. You know, then on both the GiveWell side and the open philanthropy side, we're undertaking work to try and expand the giving opportunities that we found. So for GiveWell, we are primarily looking for new programs and new organizations. This year we're looking for organizations working in a few areas. And there'll be ones, if you followed us, that probably sound familiar to you. So primarily they're groups working on vaccines, nutritional programs, primarily micronutrients, and neglected tropical diseases. In all cases, these are areas where we've looked for these organizations before. We think that it's going to be a challenge to find new top charities whose programs and activities succeed in all the ways that our current top charities do, because we have been looking for the same type of organization for 5 or 6 years now. But with our added capacity, we think we have a better opportunity to investigate them more fully than we have in the past. And then on the open philanthropy side, we've sort of divided the universe of possible areas to work in into 4 big categories. The 4 big categories that we talk about are policy. So that's philanthropy that is trying to influence governments. And so that could be something like influencing the U.S. government on something like criminal justice reform or state and local governments on their criminal justice programs. Another category is global catastrophic risks. So these are things that have a very low likelihood of happening, but if they happen, they could be catastrophic. So I think an example that people are often familiar with is an asteroid. A large enough asteroid were to hit the Earth, it could have catastrophic effects for humanity. That one in particular is something that seems like we've, meaning society, has more or less taken care of, and is not one of the major issues we're prioritizing. And you could read the full report on our website if you're interested. But it's issues like that are what we're calling part of our global catastrophic risks focus. Those are the two areas that we've made the most progress on so far. And so I'll talk a little bit more about what we're doing on them. The other two areas where we've made less progress on thus far, one is scientific research. And that's an area where it's been more challenging for us to get started because it requires, we think, a great deal of subject matter expertise to distinguish good programs from bad programs, or good opportunities from bad opportunities. And so we spent a lot of the last year and a half trying to identify and then learn how to work with scientific advisors who can help us move through the different scientific opportunities to come up with a systematic way that finds great giving opportunities. The last area is global health and development. So it's the same broad area that's covered by GiveWell's top charities, but it's potentially projects that don't meet the criteria that our current top charities meet. So it could be something like better data for global health programs that let programs run more efficiently or have larger impact. It could also be things like infrastructure, roads, internet, electricity in the developing world. So there are other programs there that we'd like to look at eventually. I think that, so right now where we are on policy and global catastrophic risks is in both areas we've done a moderate job surveying the field and have a pretty good sense of which areas we want to prioritize most highly. If you look back on our blog from a couple weeks ago, we wrote about the areas we're currently focusing on and also the ones that we looked at and didn't prioritize as highly. And our plan for this year is trying to make a hire in one higher in the policy arena, likely in criminal justice reform or in macroeconomic policy, and one higher on the global catastrophic risks side, likely in biosecurity. And this person ideally would be a relatively senior person who could lead grant-making efforts in both of those areas. So they would have a budget of $5 or $10 million. Good Ventures, the foundation that we work closely with, would be the proximate donor for this grant budget. And the person would be out there in that cause area trying to find outstanding giving opportunities. Scientific research, the primary goal we have for this year is trying to bring it to a point that is similar to where we're currently at with both global catastrophic risks and policy. And global health and development is currently deprioritized due to lack of capacity. And so those are both good examples of things that if we had more of the type of capacity we were looking for, we would probably be moving more quickly in both of those areas. So where is GiveWell going from here? You know, I think the long-term vision of what I hope GiveWell and the Open Philanthropy Project becomes is something that is significantly larger and more broad than it is today. So, you know, in the case of GiveWell, there are still a lot of areas that I don't feel we have looked at as deeply as we should have, given the current level of funding that we direct and the level of staff that we have. So, you know, this includes some of the causes I mentioned, all of the vaccines, nutrition, neglected tropical diseases, but also areas like water, education organizations. If anyone's interested, I'm happy to explain why we've prioritized things the way that we have. But as we grow and have more capacity, as I hope the world continues to get better and the opportunities for things like deworming, bed nets start to go away because donors fill those opportunities up because they're such outstanding ways to accomplish good. I think there'll be other ways that we're going to try to find that donors can still do a great deal of good. And I think those will come in some of these causes like water and education that we just haven't looked at recently. If I had to guess, I would say I don't think GiveWell itself, the traditional work, is going to get that much bigger than it currently is in terms of staff. So, I mean, I think there's, you know, roughly 12 people who are currently devoted to GiveWell work, and I could imagine that doubling or so in the steady state, but I don't think that GiveWell is going to just keep growing at the rate that it has grown over the last couple of years, because as long as it's focused on, it has its core criteria, I think it that should be a sufficient staff size to meet the needs. I think the one unknown is to what extent we're able to do a great job on outreach. Instead of just focusing on research, do a better job communicating to the outside world about what we're doing and engaging more donors in the type of work that we do. And that's certainly something that I expect to be a big part of GiveWell's future and could potentially take a lot of staff resources. I think the Open Philanthropy Project is in a very different position right now. It's very much still in startup mode where we're really trying to figure out what we should be doing and how. There's, you know, literally 4 or 5 people who spend most of their time working on this project. And so there's a ton of questions we still have to answer about how we're going to do this work well, what type of opportunities are going to be the ones that we want to fund. And I think there's, you know, I expect that when we look back in 2 years at the things we thought today, there will be a lot that's different than what we expect because it is still so new. And when I think about where most of the growth in what is currently the organization GiveWell is going to come from, I think a lot of it's going to be on the open philanthropy side because there's just going to be a lot of volume of research and public reporting and writing that needs to be done for the scale of operation that I hope that becomes. So we want to finish covering these causes, policy, global catastrophic risks, science, global health and development. At the same time, we want to continue to back check all of the conclusions we reached about what to prioritize and keep being open to new things that we should prioritize more highly. We also want to be running grant-making programs that are moving significant amounts of money to organizations in each of those spaces. And each of those programs itself, I think, will require a significant number of staff to run them. And then finally, you know, we hope that Open Philanthropy is not only a project that is shared between GiveWell and Good Ventures, but is an approach or either an approach or a specific project that a lot of the new class of tech startup founders you know, use as their means for their long-term philanthropy. So the classic model is you kind of work in your company, and then when you retire, you start a foundation, and it's the foundation is like your name or whatever, you know, it's your basic name on the foundation. You pick areas that you're passionate about, and then you give to them, and you don't share a whole lot about what you're doing, so people can't learn. And instead, what we hope is that, you know, people will, because of the existence of the Open Philanthropy Project, people will be able to get involved in philanthropy earlier, that their, where their philanthropy goes will be driven by a process of trying to strategically select areas that are likely to be most impactful, and then be open about the granting and what they're learning, which I think has the potential to have a really large long-term effect. You know, even if people don't do this through the Open Philanthropy Project, I think that we're hoping that it becomes a model for how other foundations can operate, because there's a great deal of good that could be done if every single person who is giving money away was trying to learn from it and then sharing what they learn. You know, I think that one of the, to sort of bring this back to something in my experience, and then I'll wrap up and take some questions. You know, I think one of the most surprising things to me was watching the experience that Carrie had when she was first trying to figure out where, what she should do to set up Good Ventures as a foundation, and how similar the struggle that she had to find good answers was to the struggle I had when I was trying, when I was a kid giving away a few thousand dollars. And I think it was surprising, but it's telling about how little information is really out there to help people make more thoughtful giving decisions. And, you know, I really hope that a lot of what GiveWell and Open Philanthropy does is create an ecosystem where people are able to get better information about where to give in the future. So let me pause there and open it up for any questions that you guys have. Yep.
Thank you for my first question is, how easily do you access people's data? Like, how easily are people willing to give you how many immunizations they gave? How do you negotiate that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So a lot of the time, so I'll answer this question just from the GiveWell point of view. And in general, I think most of the questions will be on GiveWell as opposed to the Open Philanthropy Project. But if you want to ask about both, then let me know and I'll answer that too. So with GiveWell, a lot of the data that we use is already publicly available. And it's not charity specific, it's program specific. So as an example, one of the charities we recommend now is the Against Malaria Foundation. They fund malaria net distributions in Africa. And there's a great deal of information that is available on the impact that net distributions generally have when they take place. And so these are in academic papers, the World Health Organization reports, the malaria. So that's one type of data that plays a heavy role in our process in understanding how well the programs work in general. And then you have the charities specifically in their data. Now, by and large, most charities do not make much information publicly available. And, you know, when we ask them, so most of them don't have publicly available information. And so then we'll go to them and ask them. Early on, this was a major problem for us, because when GiveWell started, we didn't have very much money to offer. So there wasn't a big incentive for organizations to share information with us. As GiveWell has grown and moved more money. So in our first year, we had $100,000 roughly in grants to offer. Last year, a little bit more than $28 million went to the organizations that we recommend. And so because of that incentive, organizations are more likely to want to share the data that they have. One thing that was probably most surprising to me from working at GiveWell relative to what I expected previous to GiveWell is that I think I expected organizations to have a significant amount of data that they were just holding back. And then when we like brought them this incentive of millions of dollars, all of a sudden organizations would come forward with significantly more data. And that isn't something that has really happened. Organizations are much more happy to talk to us, to take our emails, return our calls. But the amount of information that they share hasn't changed substantially. And I think that's because most organizations either don't have data or don't have data that is usable enough to be shareable. And so while it's made a huge difference to our access, it hasn't made as big a difference as you might think to the quality of the information that we get. Yep.
Leslie, thanks very much for the talk. It was really, really interesting. It'd be great if you could talk a little bit about how you prioritize good. I mean, you talked about things in priority order and doing more good by saving someone from malaria than perhaps educating a child in the US. I'm particularly interested in over a time span. I mean, would you say it's better, or how would you prioritize maybe educating 10 kids to stop them getting AIDS or HIV versus extending the life of someone who's older? And over what kind of time span do you take the good? I'm just kind of interested in how the bridge is.
Yeah, so I mean, I think that this is not an easy question to answer, and there's certainly no like simple. I mean, we don't use any sort of simple metric to try and prioritize those. You know, a lot of the most philosophical questions about how do you prioritize this good versus that good haven't played as much of a role in our work as you might have thought. So basically, we start with these criteria, which are is there evidence that this program works? Is this program cost effective? Do we have confidence that this organization implements this program effectively, and does it need marginal funding? And those four questions whittle the list of organizations down substantially. So when I think about the hypothetical organization that educates people in hopes that 10 years later they're less likely to have HIV, I think there's significantly less evidence demonstrating that that type of program works than there is that when you give out malaria nets, you save lives. And so we've, with GiveWell, focused more on the strong evidence of effectiveness and deprioritized the more speculative, less clear types of impacts.
Yep.
Given your importance based on cost effectiveness, I'm kind of intrigued as to how you've come to the neurotropical diseases as being so important, because notoriously they are neglected because they aren't cost effective to treat. They affect small numbers of people, normally very complex problems to be looked at. People like the Gates Foundation, for example, who got grants for certain neurotropical diseases that are just too complex.
Yeah, so it's a good question. So let me before answering that, I just want to give a little more context for how we talk about cost effectiveness. So conceptually, our goal is to maximize the impact per dollar. And so we're always thinking about, you know, how much good will giving to this organization do relative to some other opportunity. Now that is something that is in some ways impossible to measure. There's no single metric that I would trust that tells me the answer to that question. It's also something that I think can be, well, it's our conceptual goal. The way that most people attack it and the input we use into trying to reach that conclusion is this explicit cost effectiveness model where you're trying to say, well, how many dollars come in and then what does that accomplish in humanitarian terms for the people who are benefited? And it's extremely complex and subject to a lot of judgment calls throughout. So if you go on our website, we have a page that like will link you to all the cost effectiveness models that we've used over the years, including the one we currently use. And within that, you can see that different staff members at GiveWell have plugged in different assumptions for how cost effective the programs are. And you get variations of, I mean, at least 10 to 20x between staff members, between scenarios that staff members run. And so it's a very imprecise estimate, and that's something, I mean, it's something we're very aware of, we try to make a big deal about. So we're trying to estimate this as well as we can, while also being cognizant about how wide the uncertainty is around any estimate that we have. So with neglect, I mean, so I don't know what drove the neglectedness of these set of tropical diseases historically. I suspect that with things like vaccine preventable diseases, malaria, because people were dying, it was much easier to see the impact that the program was having because it was easy to measure what happened. And with something like the parasitic infections that the program deworming resolves, or with other neglected tropical diseases, the impacts are harder to measure, and that led people to be more gun-shy about giving to them because they weren't sure what they were getting. In our case, the biggest piece of evidence, or the biggest data point that goes into our cost-effectiveness assessment of deworming, is a paper that wasn't released until 2008 or 2009 and relies on a study that was conducted in 1998. And the finding in that paper is that they ran a randomized controlled trial of a deworming program where some kids were randomly selected to receive the treatment, some kids were selected not to receive the treatment, and 10 years later, the children who received the treatment had significantly higher wages in adulthood than the group that had not received the treatment. It was kind of a shockingly large effect. I for a long time was very skeptical of that finding. I said, I mean, how could this really be the case that a program that has so many studies already of it and doesn't find similar size short-term effects could find such a large long-term effect? The authors were kind enough to share all the data and the code with us, and one of the GiveWell analysts went through all the code. We have a page on our website, as is the case with many things, describing all the work that we did. And it held up very well to looking for any type of data mining or other fudging in the data that we had. And so we felt like that was a strong study that demonstrated a pretty large effect for a deworming program. So that's the type of effect that we see that leads to us seeing deworming as a pretty cost-effective program. There's a couple other data points involved. I should add that for a long time, people thought deworming was very cost-effective based on an estimate of the dollars per disability-adjusted life year. Averted disability-adjusted life year is a global health metric that tries to put deaths and illness into similar terms. So a disability, 1 year of life lost is like the full extent of losing your health. And if you had some significant disability, it could be something like a half or a third of a life year. And so this estimate said that deworming was $3 per disability adjusted life year, or DALY averted. That was very cost effective. We sort of dug into that estimate and found all these errors in it, and it looked like it actually should have been about 100 times as costly as the estimate initially thought. And so we tended not we didn't we don't rely as much on that figure and rely more on the this other study. I think this is a good just example to keep in mind of how it's worth being skeptical of very complicated cost effectiveness models, because it can be easy to overlook inputs that can have this extraordinarily large effect on the bottom line. Yep.
Have there been any efforts to crowdsource some of this work, right? So, I mean, you talk about limited capacity, you want to expand, but are there things that individuals just out there in the world in the EA community could be doing to contribute this, and could you leverage those people?
I think it's hard. I think the first attempt to crowdsource some of this is when GiveWell started, and we're like, well, we're only two people. We should get all our friends to help us, and we should find volunteers. And we had this giant spreadsheet of 50 people who all said they'd help us. And it took us probably 6 months to realize that we were spending more time managing them in the spreadsheet than any of the impact that they actually had. So I definitely think the notion of crowdsourcing and using volunteers is much harder in practice than it is in theory. It's also a fact that, you know, most people who contribute in significant ways at GiveWell have been there for some substantial period of time. I mean, some people come on. I mean, there's ways in which people contribute immediately. But it takes a lot of training and guidance and feedback for people to get to the point where they can meaningfully move our agenda forward. And that's just not something that we're able to do in a low-intensity way. Even something that is as straightforward as conversation notes. So for every single phone call that we do with an outside expert, if they're willing, we ask them if we can record the call, and then we write up these summaries that we post on our website of what we talked about. And producing these 3 to 4 page summaries of a call takes a consultant about 10 hours to put together. And it takes us, you know, something like 50 to 100 hours, or they take about 50 to 100 hours of training to get to the point where we say, wow, they can really produce this document to the level of quality that we need to be comfortable sending it to one of the experts who's going to review the document. So even, you know, in a case where it's something that seems pretty mundane, it takes a lot of training to get to the standards that we were hoping for. Yep.
So just switching your thinking to outreach, how do you think about selling the message of effective philanthropy as opposed to kind of social philanthropy? And I guess in the business school context, we've got plenty of people making impassioned pleas for things like the Ice Bucket Challenge or a charity that they're a cancer survivor of. And it seems very hard to push the message, well, actually, you should worry about people in Africa or people suffering from malaria in the face of that.
Yeah, the simple answer is I have no idea. I mean, I've been much happier since I decided that I wasn't going to try and convince everyone I met that giving to GiveWell's top charities is the only way they should give philanthropy. And instead, I've focused on research. That said, I mean, I think there's a couple things that I think about in that context. The first is, we feel incredibly fortunate that now there's this burgeoning movement of effective altruism that's not just GiveWell, but all these other groups that are doing research and spreading the message of effective altruism in general and often GiveWell specifically. And it's outreach work that we don't need to do because they're doing it. So, I mean, Peter Singer is the example we always bring up. He has been better than any marketing outreach person we could have found or paid. And he's done it all on his own because it was what he was trying to accomplish. And you're seeing it happen again now. He's just released a new book. Nicholas Kristof wrote an op-ed in the Times earlier this week. And, this has been, these sort of public intellectuals who spread the message have been one of the main ways that people have found us. I do think there's going to be a time where we're ready to shift some of our energy from research to outreach, and we'll try to be as thoughtful about that as we have research. I don't know. I think there's a lot of like potential ways that someone could end up selling this message. I think one possibility is just I don't want to say the same tricks that every charity uses, but I mean, when friends and family of mine give to GiveWell's top charities, I find myself instinctively responding to them, telling them how many families they gave cash to, how many bed nets they distributed, how many kids they dewormed. And I don't think it's misleading. I mean, I think these are ways of just helping people know where their money is going, even if it's a slightly simplified story of what's happening. Because these are numbers that I feel confident telling people about because, I know where they come from. The other thing I hope, and this is much more speculative and said with much less knowledge and confidence, is I think there's a lot of movements that become almost like status symbols among people. And you could easily imagine a time where it's just not acceptable to be thoughtless about your charity because it's just an unintelligent, low impact way to behave. And you can imagine a movement that has the effect where everyone wants to give this way, not necessarily because they want to have the most impact, but because it would be embarrassing not to do it. Yep.
I was wondering, how can we institutionalize effective philanthropy research in educational institutions like Harvard? Can we have a department of effective philanthropy or something? Because in the world, most research is done at universities, right? So is there more that can be done on that front?
Yeah, I don't have a good answer to that question. I think there's a challenge that university research relates to the incentives that academics have in their research and in their careers. I think and certainly there's a great deal of research that's not focused specifically on philanthropy, but supports a lot of the work that, we do in, this is through development research or, economics development research, but also on things like scientific research and, other areas that the Open Philanthropy Project could fund. I think the most concrete way in which we've thought about this is, and this might not be exactly what you're thinking of, but with the history of philanthropy project that we've started, where what we really want to understand is what has philanthropy accomplished historically? When has it accomplished what it set out to, and why? When has it failed and why? And as usual, there's shockingly little substantive information out there to help answer that question. So right now we have a handful of consultants who are history PhDs who vet specific case studies. We published one on a program that the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation ran and the Pew Memorial Trust ran on healthcare for the homeless program. But this strikes me as the type of endeavor you could imagine taking place in a university setting. But it's, it's still very early and it's hard to know what exact form that would take. Yep.
That was very interesting how you mentioned, you know, prior to GiveWell, there was just really no information comparing charities together, and that was just a huge deficit for someone who wanted to give. And I assume, you know, creating GiveWell allows people who want to do the most good and gives them a clear road to probably just dramatically increase donations to the charities that need it most. And so I'm kind of curious if you see any other just massive deficits in charities, right? Like in terms of if you're someone who wants to give charitably, is there just something that's missing, like GiveWell, that needs to be put in place? And I'm thinking of I could imagine that if you gave money to a charity and you received like $10 to a charity, you received something in return that was worth like $1, that would dramatically increase charitable giving if it was something that like was like allowed the giver to feel some sort of pride in what he did. You're just bringing in like a plaque or something like that. And I can imagine, even though that's like an inefficient use of resources, it would increase charitable giving so much for each. But because there would be so many people who would want to have some sort of tangible symbol of what they did. Whereas now, like you know, a lot of these charities, you just, you know, you give the money and it's gone. You know, I know like the Against Malaria Foundation will sometimes try to give you a report on what your money did. But I guess it doesn't serve as well for like bragging rights or something like that. But I imagine that if you could harness that energy, that the desire that most people have to brag, that you could dramatically increase donations. I'm kind of curious if there's any empirical research on that. If you think maybe GiveWell could institute something like that in the future, where like people could give money through GiveWell and get some like something in return for it, and like GiveWell could pay for it and use that money to pay for it itself. I don't know.
I mean, there's one part of philanthropy that is pretty data driven, and there's also some decent research on is fundraising, which makes sense because it's like how charities keep the doors open and it makes money. So, I mean, I think there is a decent amount of research on what works to fundraise. It's an area where there is like a decent amount of academic work on it. And I mean, so I don't know the answer to this question of what works in fundraising and whether like the approach of sending the small gift or following up or, you know, what people do to have to fundraise best. But definitely that's like something you could research and find more information about. Yeah, the Duke shirt.
Yeah.
Go Duke.
Very proud for today. So when I read the New York Times article that came out, something that struck me was in the comment section, which I don't know why I keep reading.
Next.
There was a lot of vitriol. So the story was about a hedge fund trader who donated half his income. And a lot of the comment section, there's a lot of vitriol against it saying, charity is just a band-aid. What we really need is institutional change. And that's arguments that I've come across as I've tried to make the case for effective altruism. A lot of times people say like, well, what we really need is institutional change. Charity is just a band-aid. I have my own personal ideas on that, but I'd kind of like to get your thoughts. How do you respond to those type of arguments?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, I think this is kind of this like intuitive objection that a lot of people have. My impression is that for a long time, the aid industry was focused on institutional change, and it didn't work. It is just hard to go into, I mean, this should be obvious, like to go into another country in another culture and try to change things to work more the way that we from the outside think they should work. That just is not an approach that has a strong track record of success. I also think it's just a mistake so I think that is a reflection of a certain arrogance among donors who think like we have the answer. We know how to solve this problem. And instead, what is the case is that, you know, there's no obvious root cause of poverty. We don't know how to fix it. And if we did, we wouldn't still have the problems that we do. And so a lot of what GiveWell's top charities focus on are things where they're largely trying to empower people to help themselves. So if someone is sick from malaria, if someone is weak because they have a parasitic infection, if someone is too poor to send their kids to school or have a roof over their house that lets them sleep at night. You know, these are all things that I think perpetuate poverty. And it's not just putting a band-aid on the situation. I mean, I would argue that instead it's one of the best ways to help people pull themselves out of poverty. You know, I know relatively little about like the history of what has led countries that have gone from being very poor to very wealthy, what led them to do that. But in no case was that driven by, I don't think, outside aid that was changing institutions. It was very much the countries, I think, helping themselves and, you know, putting the people in the areas in a position where they're healthier, where they have their basic needs are better met than they were before, seems like a great way to, you know, to help them get where they're hoping to be. Yeah.
I'm just interested to hear about like the behaviors of your donors. Do they come to you because they fully prescribe with your philosophy and give 100% of their philanthropy dollars, or do they only give a portion and then save some for their passion project on the side?
Yeah, it's a good question. So I would say that there's a lot of different types of donors that we serve. So one big distinction is between the larger donors and the smaller donors. So donors who are really on the high end of giving to GiveWell's top charities. So the donors who are giving, let's say, $10,000 or more versus the donors who are giving $1,000 or less. You know, I think the donors who are giving $1,000 or less, I don't really know what their motivations. I don't understand them. I haven't talked to many of them. And often they'll give in 1 year and then not come back and give again in a following year. So I think something like 75% of donors who've given in year one under $1,000 won't come back and give again in year two. And so these are donors that, I mean, I should say this is one of the best examples of a place where I think our outreach efforts are really suboptimal, that I don't even know whether we could do better. It's just something we haven't prioritized. But those are donors who, you know, I imagine them reading the article in the paper, giving once, we email them a couple of times, and then they're gone. At the higher end, you know, these donors are making a more like proactive decision to give their charity in a very different way than most people choose to give. And so there, something like 80% of them come back and give again in future years. I'd say by and large, people are giving most of their charity to GiveWell's recommendations when they're giving at that level. It's not always the case. If I had to guess, I'd say like 80% of them are giving the vast majority to GiveWell recommendations.
To come back to the New York Times article, Christoph ends by saying that while he thinks it's great that, you know, people want the most part for the money, he believes in loyalty. And so what's your take on that? And people who have a cause that may not be schistosomiasis or your top three charities, but they still want these people to benefit from that.
So, I mean, I think, you know, giving is a very personal decision and, you know, everyone has to decide for themselves, like how they want to give and what they should do. You know, the thing that motivates me in my giving is saying, you know, each year I have this money to give and I want it to do as much good as possible. And I personally would not be happy if now I had kept giving to PSI, which was the charity I gave to back in 2008, or Village Reach, which was the charity I gave to in 2010, if I think I have other opportunities today that are, you know, I mean, I think in the scheme of things, those are great organizations, but if today I have better opportunities to accomplish good, the loyalty in some sense that I feel is to the people that I could potentially help, and it's not just to the particular organization that I gave to in the past. Just to be clear, that's not to minimize the like emotional ties that donors have to charities. For a while we were doing these donor testimonials where donors who used our research would write about their decision to give based on GiveWell's research and how they felt about it. And so you can find these if you search like guest posts on the GiveWell blog. There aren't that many of them. And one donor wrote about the experience he had stopping to give to one of the charities he had previously given to. And he wrote about it as if it was ending this very serious long-term romantic relationship where he knew this charity, he had talked to them, he really liked them, they were really friendly, but it just wasn't going to work in the future. Yep.
So last week, Harvard Effector Altruists hosted a discussion with someone named Michael Vassar. And he had a lot to say, but a couple of things that he had to say were about GiveWell were that, I mean, as I just said, were that GiveWell is way too conventional and kind of boxed in its thinking, too traditional in its approach to philanthropy, and that it might be a much better idea to focus on things like life extension research or making sure that AI doesn't wipe us out or making sure that AI is, in the future, solves all our problems. Is it correct that GiveWell is kind of more focused on, is more conservative in its approach, or maybe why. And then also, is it possible that these other kinds of ideas that are more radical but could have a much bigger impact with that open philanthropy project would like evaluate those? Is that how they would trickle down into the GiveWell realm? Or is it just off the table because it's too kind of crazy?
So, yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's off the table for GiveWell as the traditional top charities work that we do. I mean, we want to keep that as a distinct brand that is all about evidence of effectiveness, fully demonstrated conclusions that you can vet down to the quote in the footnote. But it's not off the table for effective givers, and it's not off the table for Open Philanthropy Project. AI risk is one of the areas that is a relatively high priority for the Open Philanthropy Project. We have definitely talked about and aging research. And so those, I mean, that would be part of the scientific research bucket. And so really, I mean, the idea of Open Philanthropy Project is nothing off the table, is off the table. And the idea that it might be sound a little weird or wacky is definitely not a bad thing. In some ways, it's a good thing because I think causes that get less attention, other things equal, are going to be a better bet for additional funding.
So Peter Singer has been opponents, but he does criticize GiveWell occasionally, and one criticism that I notice he has is that he thinks that GiveWell relies maybe too much on RCTs, which causes them to overlook charities that are maybe not well suited to RCTs. He gives the example of charities that provide surgeries like cataracts or obstetric fistulae, where you don't really need an RCT to know that somebody's cataract has been taken out. Do you think, what's your response to
him? Yeah, I mean, I think it's a good point to raise. And I mean, just to be clear, one of the things that we really like about putting everything, doing work in the way that we do is that it invites criticism. And, you know, we're happy to discuss like why we've done things the way that we have. So the area of surgery is one of the areas that I hope we're able to cover more deeply in the future than we have in the past. And the reason that we have relied so heavily on RCTs and on charities whose programs are particularly well suited to RCTs and then this scale up, these like mass distribution programs, is that they've been the types we're able to evaluate with the capacity we currently have. And we're kind of constantly, for our entire history, we felt like we were making a trade-off between, doing one type of research versus another, and we've never felt like we had the capacity to look into everything that we want. So in the case of something like surgery, I don't think we would not need RCTs to show that, you know, assuming a charity had good enough monitoring, that the surgeries had worked, that they had persisted long term, that they weren't causing complications, you would expect to get that information from some other place. You wouldn't have that causal question that you often have. At the same time, I think that there are significant challenges to evaluating surgical programs. In particular, is the marginal funding that's flowing into the charity causing them, enabling them to do more of the work that they do? Or is there a bottleneck somewhere else in the ecosystem that's preventing the charity from doing work? So, you know, you can easily imagine a case with surgery where the bottleneck is not money, but it's surgeons. And it's not, you can't give the Fistula Foundation or any other fistula or cleft palate or cataract organization money and have them create surgeons as easily as, you know, other charities can use money and turn that into more good accomplished. That's not to say it's impossible by any means. It's just to point at, it's just to articulate the challenge that we see in evaluating them and one of the reasons that we've deprioritized for the time being. And so my, you know, one of the main way that we've prioritized our work is, you know, some combination of our intuition about which areas are most likely to yield the highest impact charities and also a guess about the return on time spent researching the organizations. And so I think it would take us, it would be a gigantic project for us right now to undertake looking at surgery organizations well and feeling like we were able to be confident in the impact of additional funding. And so we've deprioritized that relative to other areas that we think we can look into and make more progress in the short term, but it's certainly something I hope to get to eventually. Yep.
So new, but not doesn't really fit in the standard tech. I was wondering, sort of when you were setting out on this, what sort of doubts you had, both about the organization itself and your personal capacity to fill it. And if you really, you have the vision that in 10 years you'd probably still be doing this, or you think it was sort of like something you might start, and then, I don't know, what did you think walking in?
So I don't know how helpful this answer will be. I think I was just unbelievably naive. And I remember having conversations with people saying things like, they're like, you're crazy for doing this. I'm like, but in 2 years, we'll be moving $100 million. So it's obviously a good thing to do. And I think I literally had no idea what to expect. And it wasn't until we were, I think it was about when we were a year in. And I remember talking to some early advisors and I was like, this doesn't feel like those stories about starting something in your garage where it's like so fun and awesome all the time. And they're like, oh yeah, those are fantasies. Like really the first few years are just pain and suffering. And you sort of hope to come through it. And if you do, then that's great. But there were a lot of times where there was some serious doubt in our minds that we would ever, you know, anyone would ever care. We'd be able to find charities that we wanted to recommend, find donors that wanted to give to those charities, do research that was reasonable quality, find anyone at all who cared about what we were doing. And it's in hindsight, it's much more surprising than it seemed at the time, because early on it seemed obvious that everyone should just want to do this.
I'm wondering if you could speak to, if we all go out and we're working these different organizations, perhaps we want to start our own charity, what kind of things can we do on the side of data collection or selection of our motivated organizations based behind them that, to you, and I guess to your mission, would make us a good charity? I mean, how can you bring to that organization to produce the kind of data you're looking for?
So I think the most important thing, or one of the most important things, is choosing the area that you work in really well. You know, it's particularly when it comes to like starting a charity, I think it's like very unlikely that I'll ever be really excited about like another charter school. I don't want to pick on charter schools, but I mean, it's just like not the type of thing that I think will end up wanting to give a lot of money to. And on the other hand, you know, someone who figures out a way to deliver vitamin A to parts of the developing world that don't already have this outstanding program, or gets immunization to the last 20% of people who are not receiving immunizations, or attacks one of the areas on the open philanthropy side that are, I mean, we're hardly able to even focus on because no one's working on them. I mean, I think that is one way of trying to pick things that we would be excited about. When it comes to like one's own career path, you have to think about other things like, what am I good at? What am I excited about? I mean, I think if I wasn't just incredibly excited about the research that GiveWell does on a day-to-day basis, there's like no chance that I would have succeeded, even though I think it's a really, you know, even if I thought it was the important thing to create, a lot of it had to be that when things looked like they wouldn't work out or things were really tough, it was fun to read the charity reports and, you know, try to figure out what was the best place to give.
You mentioned capacity constraints about 4 or 5 times. Other than your own personal time, which is clearly a resource, I mean, is it financial or is it finding the right people? And I guess leading on from that, have you ever considered that perhaps, given the effect that GiveWell is having, maybe the best use of one particular donor's capital may be to invest in GiveWell itself to expand the reach and have an exponential effect on your charity? I was just wondering how you thought about that.
So it's 100% people and zero financial. We need to fundraise. We're not independently self-sufficient. But we have always felt more bottlenecked on finding the right people rather than being able to find the money to expand. And the challenge is finding people who can contribute at the most challenging level of work. And that can mean different things. That can mean taking responsibility for an entire area of work. in a way that doesn't require time from someone else who's relatively senior. On the research side, I think projects just span the spectrum from very well-defined research projects. So that could be something like, here's a page, make sure that every single statement on the page is footnoted and well-supported by the claim. That is like well-defined. To a very open-ended question, which is, what are the good places to give in global health and development? And it's finding the type of people who, you know, that's an extraordinarily wide spectrum, but virtually everything we do falls somewhere in between those two poles, and finding people who can contribute at the more open-ended side of the spectrum has been incredibly challenging. We definitely have, if, you know, it took us a few years to hire anyone. We have now found some people who are, you know, really excellent in contributing at extremely open-ended ways. But we don't have the formula where we think, you know, we can just go to this place and bring on 10 more people who could do exactly that type of work. And if we could, we would in a minute.
So it sounds like you need to hire someone who's good at finding those types of people.
So, I mean, but obviously, like, hiring that person would be incredibly tough. I mean, everyone is looking for, I mean, I think the type of person that will contribute in the types of projects that I'm talking about would be able to do a ton of different things. And they're the type of person that, I mean, basically everyone is trying to hire. Yep.
Combining two earlier questions, one about crowdsourcing and one about, like, what kind of charity could we do to attract people. Have you thought of something like extremely high-level crowdsourcing? Not like, hey, can somebody transcribe this interview, but more like, hey, can somebody found a charity to distribute vitamin A in Nigeria? Or can somebody please design a field trial to test the effect of so-and-so? And of course, very few of them would get done, but even if, you know, even if one of these things got done, it might be super helpful. You just had a, you know, a brainstorming page on GiveWell, all of these giant things that we wish existed.
Yeah, so I think you're right that it is unlikely to do very much if we had this page, but we're actually like going to put this type of page up, which is like charities we'd like to see existing. We talk about it. We have these ideas internally, and we might as well share them in the case that they like help someone do something.
So back to that question about kind of career choice, I think a lot of people who are EA inclined are also encouraged to think kind of counterfactually, but are also encouraged to consider earning to give and have all these sort of career options and try to discount like the tendency to go for the direct effect. But it sounds like what you're suggesting is that actually there is a bottleneck on that kind of talent and that kind of inclination. So what would you say to people who are considering going to a career where they can earn to give, or going to a career where they can actually like directly help? Or like, do you think that lots of other organizations have your same problem?
I don't know as much about other organizations. I know for GiveWell specifically, we would way rather have one more stupendous research employee than like $1 million a year in money moved. Like there's just no question like what is the bigger bottleneck to us right now. And so we would way rather have people applying to us for jobs and then becoming like awesome researchers than have them earning to give. I mean, obviously if they're not a good fit for us, then, you know, then it's a more difficult question, but the trade-off is not, we're not ambivalent about that trade-off. I don't know. I do think with career choice, there's a Holden, who's my co-founder. He did a conference call where there's like audio, and he wrote up some notes on career choice that's on our website somewhere, which I'm happy to send out if it's hard to find. But I think he gave pretty good advice about that. And I think some of the key things to keep in mind in career choice are thinking about, you know, what you are particularly good at relative to other people, what you're really interested in relative to other people. And certainly when you're very young and like coming right out of college, like thinking about your building career capital in a way that, you know, where you'll probably have your biggest impact 10 years from now, not right when you leave school. And so keeping in mind like where you're heading is probably useful as well.
Can you share your algorithm for making charitable donations and maybe how they played out to objectable donations in last years? or is it too personal?
No, I'm happy to talk about that. I mean, we write these posts every year that are like how GiveWell staff gives. So I think a lot of what happened this year is we felt like the organizations we recommended each had a relatively limited amount of capacity for funding at the end of this year. And so a lot of where our recommendation of how we recommended that people give and then how staff members gave individually was driven by the consideration that organizations at a certain point, they would have diminishing utility of marginal funding. In my case in particular, one of the things that I discounted more relative to other GiveWell staff was these cost-effectiveness models that we build. So this is where I'm very much an outlier relative to everyone, or not everyone else, but many other people on staff. I mean, I think the models are really helpful to some extent, but there's also a lot of uncertainty in them. And so what I ended up doing was basically putting more weight on organizational effectiveness and less weight on the model. And that caused me to give more to Give Directly, which gives out cash, and slightly less to the Against Malaria Foundation that gives out bed nets, even though the model implied that bed nets were 5 to 10x as cost effective as cash transfers. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
Cool. All right. Thank you.